In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the rise of independent film and the place that two big players had in that rise, one being the Sundance Film Festival and the other being the Miramax Film Studio. Maybe film studio is the wrong kind of word to describe what Miramax is and what they do. The fact of the matter is that it wasn't all that long ago that the festival, Sundance, was a pretty obscure event that took place in the snows of Utah. And Miramax, well, it certainly wasn't the big player in the business that it is today. However, that has now changed. Sundance is one of the most important festivals anyplace, and Miramax is a major player in the movie business, and it's part of the great Disney empire. And over that time that both of those entities have gotten bigger, independent film has certainly gotten bigger. And in fact, some people would argue that it's been a victim of its own success, that it wasn't what it started out to be, and it's not really that much independent anymore. I'll be talking this morning with writer Peter Biskind. He is the author of a new book that looks at the rise of independent film and how Miramax and Sundance contributed to that. The book is titled Down and Dirty Pictures. It's published by Simon & Schuster and is out now. Just pretty new in the bookstore if you're interested in taking a look at it. He's the author of three previous books, including Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood, and that's basically about films of the 1970s. He's also contributed to Vanity Fair and formerly executive editor of Premiere Magazine, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. Anybody can call in talk with the guest. We just ask people to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in a lot of callers. So if you'd like to call, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Biskind, hello.
Yes, hello.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
Well, very glad to do it.
The book begins at the point where Steven Soderbergh brings his film Sex, Lies, and Videotape to Sundance, and that was certainly a turning point in his career and a turning point for the festival, and actually it also marks an important milestone for Miramax. But if we could set all that aside for the moment, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what Sundance was like before that and what it was that Robert Redford was hoping to do with that festival.
Well, I started going to the first year that Sundance took over the festival was 1985, and actually I started going that year and went, I think, for maybe 4 or 5 years in a row. And it was a totally obscure event. Despite the Redford name, you couldn't pay press to go to that festival. I remember the first year I went in 85, Maria Shriver turned up with a television camera, and they couldn't get anyone to talk to her. And I talked to her because nobody else would or could, apparently. But she was the only person. She was the only press person there, and the films were, for the most part, outside of the film that won the Grand Jury Prize that year, which was the Coen Brothers' Blood Simple, the films were totally forgettable. So it was, you know, it was an invisible event in a tiny ski resort in Utah. Redford, oddly enough, the festival had existed under a different name and different auspices for a number of years before Sundance took it over. It was called the U.S. Film Festival. Redford opposed Sundance taking the festival over. He was against film festivals in principle. He felt they were too competitive. They set one filmmaker against the other and just didn't want to do it. But he was convinced and sort of dragged, screaming and kicking into the festival. So I think from Redford's point of view, he wasn't expecting anything from the festival and didn't want to do it. I think from the point of view of the people who persuaded him, Sundance up to that point had been effective with its lab program, which was getting young first-time filmmakers with scripts out to the Sundance Resort, allowing them to shoot scenes from their scripts, and then having Hollywood heavyweights critique the results. That had gone very well, but that was on the production side. I think people felt that it was important to get these films shown and that the festival could do that.
Hmm. Well, that seems like that always has been and still is a problem for independent filmmakers. First of all, you have a struggle to get the film made, but then it's a struggle to get anybody to put it someplace where anybody could see it.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the beginning, people underestimated that the second part of that process, you know, that the struggle was to raise money and then shoot the film. And once you'd done that, somehow I think people felt distribution and exhibition would take care of itself, but they don't, of course. And so when you're sort of exhausted, you're deeply in debt, and then you're faced with the problem of how to get people to see your film, and sometimes it's almost impossible.
Well, obviously, what's happened is that we started out with something with this Sundance, the institute, the thing that was intended to be an incubator for young filmmakers to give them the opportunity to learn and develop their craft. And then from there, someone said, "Well, there's no point in helping these people make their movies if nobody can see them." So then it created a venue for displaying that kind of work. But what's happened, of course, is over time that it's become an enormous event, and it's become in a sense a creature of Hollywood. So you have to ask, well, what happened? I mean, how is it that the thing got blown up to the sort of monstrous, I guess maybe we'll put that in relative terms, but the monstrous proportion that it is today, being something that is now, like the rest of the movie business, pretty much about making money?
Well, I think that, you know, when you spoke earlier about independents being, in some sense, too successful for their own good, I mean, once you have a film like Sex, Lies, and Videotape in '89 that was became such a huge hit, it grossed $25 million, suddenly the festival got the reputation for being a place where if you were a filmmaker, you could go, be discovered, and sell your film. That sense was magnified, in the subsequent years when many other films found distributors at Sundance, and what started to happen was that it became a magnet for Hollywood. In the beginning, you never find an agent or a producer at Sundance. In fact, the festival was, and Sundance in general was, arose in a kind of anti-Hollywood mode. It opposed, in opposition to what Hollywood stood for. Well, suddenly, when people realized that a film like Sex Lies could emerge and do so well from the festival, you had agents and producers coming, and then you had movie stars, and suddenly the festival became a magnet for the press. At the same time, Sundance in the beginning of the late 80s, beginning of the 90s, was doing really badly. It was desperate for money and sponsors, and one of the ways they could make money was to sell off bits and pieces of the festival to various sponsors. So gradually, you had an increased presence by companies like Mercedes-Benz and The Gap, until pretty soon almost every inch of Sundance was sponsored in one way or another, including you could buy Sundance wear at after ski wear at various kiosks around Park City. So it's just, over the next 10 years, it just became more and more commercial, and it became more of a market than a festival. So if you look at the press coverage, you'll notice that the press focuses a lot on how much films are selling for, as opposed to that's a great movie and that's a new, young, talented director.
Mm-hmm. Well, in addition to being a place where directors, young directors, thought that they could get attention, recognition, distribution for the film, launch a career, I'm sure that people also in the business of distributing and selling movies, were looking for hot properties. And particularly, they were looking for movies that they could buy relatively cheaply and then turn around and make lots of money on. And certainly that happened too.
Yeah, that did happen. I mean, distributors started flocking to the festival thinking that they were going to find the next Sex Lies. In fact, that was a question that that everyone asked in the years immediately following Sex Lies, people would come to the festival and they would ask, what's this year's Sex Lies? It's also true that, as this sort of the competition for films increased, it was no longer possible to get a film cheaply. You know, in the beginning, in the early 90s, you could pick up a film at the festival for a couple $100,000s. But as the competition among the distributors got fiercer, partly due to the fact that Miramax, with Disney money — Disney bought Miramax in 1993, was just throwing money around and taking everything off the table — eventually these films started to cost substantial amounts of money, and it seemed as if, at the high point of this acquisitions bubble, you could easily pay $10 million to pick up a film.
Has this changed, or how — I know it has, I guess I should ask the question — how has this changed the kind of movie that you see at Sundance?
Well, Sundance itself isn't, certainly isn't entirely responsible for the transformation of independent film. I think Miramax played a huge role in that as well. But eventually, over the course of, this decade, the independent films became more expensive, bigger budgets. They delivered more of what's called in Hollywood production value, more expensive locations. The films were more ambitious, and they often had big Hollywood stars. So that some people argue that they became less and less distinguishable from Hollywood movies.
Well, I guess that leads us around to the question — maybe it was the question that I should have asked at the very beginning — and that is, what is independent film anyway?
Well, when independent film started, and I was saying a minute ago that Sundance was born in a very sort of anti-Hollywood sort of mood. When independent film started in the 80s, they were anti-Hollywood. In other words, an independent film pretty much was anything that Hollywood wasn't. If Hollywood made big-budget movies, independents made small-budget movies, low-budget movies. If Hollywood made big comic strip genre films that lent themselves to being sequelized, independents made small human stories which were represented the unique vision of the filmmaker, and you could never imagine a sequel to an independent film. If Hollywood used big stars, independents dispensed with stars or used non-actors even. Hollywood had happy endings. Movies had happy endings. Independent films would often be downbeat and without happy endings. And often, if Hollywood films were so-called high concept, where you could boil down the whole notion or the premise of the movie into a sentence, independent films were character-driven as opposed to action-driven. So if you just go, profile a Hollywood movie and describe it in all its characteristics, independent films are the opposite. Now, that whole profile of independent films started to change as they became more and more successful throughout the 90s.
Let me introduce again our guests for this part of Focus 580, Peter Biskind. He is the author of the book Down and Dirty Pictures, the subtitle Miramax, Sundance, and the Rise of Independent Film. And as the subtitle suggests, it looks at what's happened with independent film and the role that both Miramax and Sundance have played in that. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. It's out now just recently in the bookstore if you want to look at it. Here in Champaign-Urbana, of course, if you want to call in, 333-9455. That's for local folks here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. In the book, there are a number of people here who loom large in the story that you have some criticism of, and one of them comes in for some criticism, maybe not the most, but one is Robert Redford. And I wonder what you think about the job that he's done kind of overseeing Sundance, and whether, in fact, if it's not what it was intended to be, or maybe not what film purists would want it to be, how much of the responsibility lies with him?
Well, I think, it's one of those glass half empty, glass half full situations. I mean, there would be no Sundance without Redford. It was his idea. And he launched it, and he stuck with it through some very, very rough times. So I think, you know, before saying anything else, one has to give him credit for that. On the other hand, he is a movie star, you know, with a movie star's personality, which is to say that he's a control freak. He wants to have his hand on every single button in the organization. And yet he has a day job, which is that of an actor and a director. So he disappears for a period of time. So what you have is a situation over the years where he couldn't run the organization himself on a day-by-day basis. On the other hand, he was very reluctant to let anybody else do it. And that created a kind of a gridlock or a crisis, an ongoing crisis of leadership. So I think the one of the criticisms one has to make about make of Sundance, in addition to the gradual commercialization of the organization, or at least the festival, is that it could have had a lot more impact and influence than it does now. In other words, Redford set in motion a lot of initiatives. For example, he was going to organize or establish a chain of movie theaters at one point in the mid-90s, and that effort collapsed for various reasons, but not the least of which was, I think, his managerial limitations. He was going to start another production company, which would have produced, you know, 10 or 15 low-budget films a year, independent films, and that collapsed, again, I think, as a function of his limitations. He's not a particularly effective manager or boss. You know, people who work for him, generally speaking, don't speak well of him. And you know, so those, I think, are the major criticisms one might make of him.
We have some callers to bring into the conversation. We'll go first to someone in Joliet on our toll-free line, line 4.
Good morning.
Yes.
Listen, this is a little off the point, so stop me. But my brother's an actor, and I'm wondering, how does a person get involved in independent films? Is it the same way you would get involved in a standard film, like you have an agent and you do an audition, or is it more like you know the people producing the film? And
well, it can be both. You know, I mean, independent films are not quite as independent filmmakers are not quite as protected as you know, big successful Hollywood directors are. So, you know, I think, you know, in the LA and New York communities, people who young actors and directors and pretty much know each other. It's a small group of people, and so you can, in some sense, get into those films by networking. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, it is advisable to have an agent and have your agent, you know, keep an eye out for interesting scripts and put you up for them. And then sometimes if the filmmaker doesn't know you, I mean, filmmakers differ. They have different processes, but some filmmakers want you to read. Other times you can just, you know, have lunch with a person.
Well, he's actually middle-aged. He's been doing it for a long time, but he's kind of in a dry spell right now, and I was just looking out for him. So
well,
thanks a lot.
That's good. Good.
All right. Let's go to Charleston for another caller here. Line 1. Hello.
Hey, how's it going today?
Good.
Couple things I want to say. You know that independent films are really getting big when not just Miramax, you know, which is owned by Disney, but just about every major Hollywood studio has some kind of art house or label for independent films. Like, you know, Sony has one, Paramount, MGM has one. You know it's getting big. Like I say, you know it's getting big when something like that's going on. The second point is there's still some pretty good little independent film festivals throughout the country. I'm from St. Louis, and there's a pretty good one every November down there, the St. Louis International Film Festival. It brings in films, independent films from all over the world, and hope with starting to get more of an emphasis on the St. Louis area filmmaking and things like that.
Well, all of that's true. I mean, there are a lot of important small festivals, not as important as Sundance, but nevertheless, you know, people get their films shown. And yes, practically every studio, I think every single studio now has an independent division.
Yeah, I guess it's good for their bottom lines. But some of the films I've seen at St. Louis in recent years have been pretty good. And one in particular that I saw a couple years ago, probably sure to, you know, maybe sure get some kind of distribution deal.
Mm-hmm. What film was that?
It was a film called April Is My Religion. It was totally locally produced, shot, and cast and everything.
Well, it's an interesting point that, you know, a lot of films, you know, a lot of good films don't get distribution deals, and now some of them are going to cable, and I think pretty soon there'll be additional outlets, you know, sort of circumventing theaters, but...
video on demand and things like that?
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously, there's two channels devoted to independent film, you know, IFC and the Sundance Channel, which I think is probably part of the Showtime Viacom thing, if I'm not
right.
mistaken. I don't know who owns IFC, but I've seen both films on both of those channels, and I've seen some pretty good ones in the past.
Yeah, but both those channels show good films, no question about it.
I think I saw one, I think Super Bowl weekend was a couple of guys went throughout Massey in Ohio and documented the high school football team season. I mean, that town is pretty much obsessed with high school football.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yes.
And it was good.
Yeah.
All right,
well,
thanks, guys.
All right, thanks for the call. That I think it does raise an interesting question about what sort of larger impact Sundance has had if it's changed, and maybe it's more difficult for smaller films to get seen there. Have people looked at the experience of Sundance in other places, either where there were existing festivals or places that said, well, you know, heck with Sundance, we can have our own festival, and has that indeed resulted in some increase in opportunities for smaller films, for independent films to be shown?
Well, I mean, an oppositional festival arose right in the belly of the beast. In other mm-hmm. words, right in Park City, during Sundance, a festival called Slam Dance started in about 1995, and it was in opposition to Sundance, and it started precisely because the people who started Slam Dance felt Sundance was becoming too commercial, and Slam Dance only takes first-time directors and directors without distribution deals. But, you know, there are definitely other festivals across the country. There's a festival, a very nice festival in Austin, Texas, South by Southwest. And there's, of course, Telluride, which is actually pre-existed Sundance. It's probably the oldest and most venerable independent or festival that shows a lot of interesting, although it's not exclusively independent. And then there are other festivals as well.
Let's take another caller here. Someone on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that not only are Sundance and IFC showing independent films, but we need to give a lot of credit to Showtime and to HBO. They basically, I don't know which one did which, Emma Thompson was in Wit, the first release of The Last Seduction, I believe, was on Showtime. And I've heard that a lot of actors have wanted to go to HBO and Showtime and basically the premium movie channels because the production is done much more efficiently and it takes less of their time to do. And and Hysterical Blindness with Uma Thurman, which is an incredible film. So I think some of the major movie channels are, in fact, independent film channels, if you will. So I just wanted to make sure that they get credit as well as the other big guns, so to speak. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think HBO is to the networks as the independents are to Hollywood, and certainly I think some of the best work is being done on HBO right now.
We I mentioned right at the beginning that your book starts with in 1989, and that year when Steven Soderbergh came to the festival and brought Sex, Lies, and Videotape. And that was a very important turning point in his career and in that of the festival, but also in Miramax, because that was because they bought the movie. And that's really what started them on the road that they are now. Before that, what was Miramax?
Well, Miramax was a tiny company that was started in 1979. The Weinsteins had been rock promoters in Buffalo. And one way or another, they got into showing movies in their theater. They moved their company to New York in 79. And when they started, they were distributing softcore porn and rock videos, and the music was their, you know, that was their background. The first movie they made a substantial amount of money on was a film called The Secret Policeman's Other Ball, which was a concert/comedy, British comedy routine film with the Pythons and Beyond the Fringe and a lot of music that was done as a benefit for Amnesty International. That film made about $6 million, and that really started them on their career. But they didn't, you know, they had indifferent success through the 80s. By 89, they got on a roll with a film called Scandal about the Profumo scandal in England in the early 60s, and then that was followed quickly by Sex Lies, and that same year they also put out My Left Foot, yeah. And then right after that, Cinema Paradiso. So they had like four big hits in a row.
Miramax is headed by these two guys, these two brothers, one more high profile than the other, Harvey, a man who in the story looms large literally and figuratively. He's a guy who seems to have managed to find people to make movies, or people who had made movies that pleased audiences, that pleased some critics at least, and made money in spite of being a famous bully and someone inclined to meddle where he shouldn't. So you have to ask, when you look at his track record, whether in fact this man is some kind of a genius, or is he just lucky, particularly in those cases when he wanted to do something to a movie and somehow someone, actors, directors, somebody said, no, you can't do that. And so he wasn't able to do what he wanted. Is he lucky, or is he a genius, or is he a little of both?
Well, I guess he's a little of both, although I wouldn't use the word lucky, because it's happened too often for it to be luck. Mm. You know, his track record is too consistent. Of course, everybody in the movie business makes bad guesses upon occasion, but the Weinsteins do have a remarkable record. I think what's sort of extraordinary is that given his personality, his aggressiveness, his bellicosity, it's sort of amazing that he has managed to continue to attract filmmakers of one sort or another and continue to turn out hits. But it's true that he's a very, very aggressive, angry guy and a bit of a bully. Early on, he was given the name of Harvey Scissorhand, as you mentioned, which refers to the fact his penchant for cutting films that filmmakers considered already finished. So he would take a film and think nothing about cutting 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes out of it. And as he became more and more successful, he became more ambitious in the extent to which he would reconfigure someone's movie. So that in addition to cutting or recutting, he would also shoot a new ending, say, or shoot more footage for the middle of the film, or revoice a film. And a lot of people feel that he's a kind of a filmmaker manqué, that he's directing vicariously through other filmmakers. And he himself calls his relationship with filmmakers collaborative. So, you know, if you sell a film to Harvey, unless it tests really well, you can expect a lot of input, so to speak, from Miramax.
What was it about Sex, Lies, and Videotape that grabbed so many people and was so important for not only the director, obviously for Steven Soderbergh, but for the festival and for Miramax?
Well, I think it was, I asked this question of the actor Edward Norton, and, you know, he essentially said that Sex Lies was kind of the graduate for that generation. Hmm. You know, there's a line in the film where the James Spader character says, and this is a character whose entire life possessions could fit in the trunk of his car. He says he would like to simplify his life so that he only needs one key. And that Norton pointed that as kind of the essence of the film. I think it was an anti-yuppie film. You know, looking back, you know, it came in '89, the end of the Reagan era, the sort of me decade. And I think it represented a sort of disgust, you know, and the villain of the film is kind of a, you know, played by Peter Gallagher is clearly a, you know, well, you know, it's a lawyer, but he's, you know, of that, you know, clearly a yuppie. Once you wear suspenders, it's a dead giveaway in a film like that. I think it's a reaction against the 80s in a sense of disgust at the materialism that consumed people during that decade.
And it seems to me that on the list of people that in this book that you actually have admiration for, Soderbergh is one of them. What about him? And he's also somebody who certainly has emerged as an important figure in the field of independent film.
Yeah, I'm a big Soderbergh fan. You know, as you pointed out, I mean, there's the films he's made, especially in the last couple of years when he finally, found a footing. You know, Traffic, Aaron Brockovich, the British film with Terrence Stamp. Ocean's 11, you know, but the other thing about Soderbergh, which I find very interesting and unusual, is the fact that once he became successful, he became a kind of one-man Sundance, which in a way shows you how much can be done by just one person as opposed to a huge organization. He gave his own money to some certain filmmakers to finance their productions or part of their productions, and he also got on the phone to filmmakers that he respected and said something like, I have a lot of power now. What I'm going to use it for is to try to get other filmmakers, the films of other filmmakers made. If you have a script in your drawer that you'd like to produce, I'll become your executive producer and I'll use whatever influence I have with the distributors or the studios to get you financing. And he ended up executive producing, a substantial number of films. Plus that, he's not afraid, after making these enormous hits, to experiment and do things like K Street, which wasn't, I don't think anybody thinks is entirely successful, but was an interesting experiment. Ditto Full Frontal, after making, $50 million movies, turn around and make a $2 million movie. Again, not entirely successful, but I think an admirable attempt.
Let's go back. I want to go back and talk a little bit more about Miramax. We talked about how important Sex, Lies, and Videotape was for Soderbergh, for Sundance, and also for Miramax. But an even bigger moment was Pulp Fiction. Again, also because of what this did, again, I think for the festival, for Miramax, for independent film, for good and for ill, what was the importance, you think, of Pulp Fiction as a film and then also as a property for Miramax?
Well, I think it's interesting to point out that when you asked earlier what's an independent film, Pulp Fiction was at a studio, TriStar, and it was just too weird for TriStar. In other words, it was a film that couldn't be made within the studio system. TriStar put it into turnaround, which means they essentially sold it, and Miramax, to their credit, bought it. It's, I think, a really brilliant movie with a character with all the Quentin Tarantino characteristics, which is to say that it's kind of a genre film. At the same time, it's sort of a meta-genre film. It's a meditation on that genre. The chronology is all is fractured. It's hard, and yet it has a lot of very commercial characteristics. And I think it was the first of, in terms of what its overall significance is, it was the first of a hybrid between a traditional independent film and a studio film, which is to say, it had many characteristics of both, of the of the old independence or the original independence, and of a studio film. It had stars like Bruce Willis and John Travolta. At the same time that it was, it was filled with references to Jean-Luc Godard and had a fractured narrative, and it was very violent and strange in many different ways. The impact of the film was enormous. It was kind of the Star Wars of independent film. It grossed over $100 million, which was way more that any independent film had grossed up to that point. And it showed, you know, and I think what happened was that a lot of independent distributors lost interest in the smaller films because they said, hey, look at this, we can make a huge amount of money if we play our cards right. At the same time, the studios, who pretty much ignored the independent business up to this point, decided there was real money to be made there, and they started their independent divisions, which, as the caller said a minute ago, every studio has one at this point. So it really marked a sea change, pushing independent films into another, up to another level, and set the stage for, I think, the situation that we have today.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Peter Biskin, and his book is Down and Dirty Pictures, Miramax, Sundance, and the Rise of Independent Film, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. He's the author of three previous books, including Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood. That's about movies of the 70s. He's contributing contributor to Vanity Fair and also formerly executive editor of Premiere magazine. Questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm really I'm interested in what you might have to say about Quentin Tarantino, since he was somebody that has become a celebrity. Celebrated, an important figure in independent film, and yet that's based on not very much work. Is this guy a great director or not, or does this say something about the power of this segment of the industry to grab onto somebody, to elevate that person, in part because they think they're going to ride that horse and going to make a lot of money, but at the same time, it's kind of an empty... kind of an empty product.
Well, you know, excuse me, Quentin Tarantino's films are controversial and people differ in their response. I myself happen to be a Quentin Tarantino fan. I think his films are really terrific. It's true that he's only directed four films, but you have to add to that True Romance, which he wrote the script to and was directed by Tony Scott, but it's very, very much a Quentin Tarantino film, and I think a very brilliant film as well. And I think you also have to put his career in context, which is to say, the book that I wrote about the 70s, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, you have directors like Billy Friedkin, who were then considered major directors, who essentially directed two good movies, The French Connection and The Exorcist, and that's it. Never directed another decent movie in his life, and yet he's still considered, you know, one of the foremost auteurs of the 70s. Look at also Peter Bogdanovich, three movies, The Last Picture Show, What's Up, Doc, and Paper Moon. So, you know, directors' reputations can very well stand on, you know, two films or three films and sometimes even one film. At the same time, I think you have to say that you're right. I mean, Quentin, Tarantino became the first rock star director, and I think the some of the consequences of that were unfortunate, which is to say, his example attracted a lot of the wrong kinds of people into filmmaking. You know, in other words, people would go into film, independent filmmaking, thinking they were going to become suddenly overnight rich and famous instead of people who had a real vision or artistic, something artistic they wanted to put on film.
Are there other directors, we talked about him a little bit, you talked about Steven Soderbergh, that are directors whose work particularly you admire? I mean, of this young crop of directors who came up through the independent...
In the 90s.
Yeah.
Well, I'm also very high on David O. Russell, who directed Three Kings for Warner Brothers. Now, that's a great example of a kind of a... Well, actually, it's not, because I was going to say it's a great example of one of these studio indie hybrids, but in a way, it's even though it had major stars, George Clooney and Mark Wahlberg, it's so independent in its whole conception that it's sort of a miracle that he managed to get it made out of studio, Warner Brothers, which was one of the most conservative studios at that time. But Russell also made Flirting with Disaster, his second film for Miramax, and his first film, Spanking the Monkey, All of them very, very different kinds of movies and all very interesting. And he's got a new film coming out now called I, Heart Huckabees, which I guess will be out in a couple months. So I think he's extremely talented. Of course, Alexander Payne, Wes Anderson, P.T. Anderson. There's a slew of, I think, interesting young directors.
Is, again, I know we're sort of jumping around here, but I'm coming back to Miramax. Miramax, you know, they've come a long way from the point they started out where they were distributing B-movies, softcore porn, and rock videos, coming out of their experience as being involved in as rock impresarios, the two Weinstein brothers, to the point where they are now. It was bought by Disney in 1993. So you have to, I guess you have to ask the question, when is the line crossed and when do we say that Miramax becomes a major studio?
Well, I think, there's, you know, right in the middle of that decade, 1994, when Pulp Fiction came out and grossed $100 million, the next year, 1995, Miramax put out two very controversial movies, Priest, about a homosexual Catholic priest, and Kids, about teenage sexuality, set in New York City. They got an enormous amount of flack for both of those movies, and then they went on in 1998 to win an Oscar, Best Picture Oscar, for Shakespeare in Love, which was a, you know, a very appealing, excuse me, but very, you know, inoffensive and not, you know, inoffensive film. And I think they decided at that point, why are we taking these risks and getting all this flack and criticism and from pressure groups for films like Priest and Kids, which don't make any money, when we could be making costume dramas like Shakespeare in Love and win an Oscar and everybody loves us. So I think the studio really took a conservative turn in those years, and now, I mean, you know, Harvey has a contrarian sense, which I think is served him in good stead, and so he's still putting out some interesting small movies, like this year, The Magdalena Sisters, or Station Agent, or the Barbarian Invasions, but I think his heart is with the big-budget studio-like movies, like Cold Mountain, with major stars and, you know, upwards of $80 million budget. I mean, he's really made no secret of the fact that he wants to compete with the studios.
Hmm. But, yeah, I guess you got to wonder whether he actually can do that. I know a lot of people have said that, you know, the issue with that movie, perhaps the reason that it wasn't more successful is it didn't quite put its toe across the line, and he wasn't willing to commit to the kind of money that you have to spend if you're going to have big stars and you're going to make a big quote-unquote Hollywood movie.
Well, that's true. You know, his Harvey's edge has always been to making medium budget movies, mid-level budget movies of, you know, $30-40 million, which look like they're $80 million movies. Cold Mountain was a movie that was an $80 million movie, and yet, you know, in the beginning when he was trying to cast it, he wanted Tom Cruise, but he wasn't willing to pay Tom Cruise's price because he, you know, I think he still in his head wanted to make the movie for a lower budget. So he didn't get Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise wouldn't cut his price. Now, in the past, stars like that would cut their price because Miramax could say it was a small independent, struggling, and so forth. But now, of course, it can't say that anymore, and there's no reason for stars like Cruise to cut their price. So he had to go for a lesser cast, which meant that the movie was what they call a tweener, which was somewhere between an independent and a big Hollywood movie, but in certain ways, although I think it was a good movie, it was the worst of both worlds.
Let's talk with another caller here, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Fascinating film, fascinating show. Thanks for coming on. I have one question. I'm wondering how Sundance and the big studios coming in and taking ownership over this independent genre has impacted the accessibility and perhaps the exclusivity of the field of filmmaking for the new artists who are coming out into this area, for the new filmmakers.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, you know, selling independent films at Sundance or any other festival, for that matter, to distributors is not solely a bad thing. I mean, in other words, it puts money in the pocket of the filmmakers and makes it possible for them to go on and make their next movie. So it's, again, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, I think in general, the revolution in digital technology is going to be, make it possible for filmmakers to make films for very little money, which I think is a good thing. So you're going to have a lot more young filmmakers grabbing digital high-definition cameras and making their films for a couple hundred dollars instead of $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 or $100,000. And so I think that we're going to have a lot of new filmmakers coming up from the bottom, which as I said, a good, you know, can only be seen as a good thing.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call. I want to ask you about something else that but certainly ties in what we're talking about, and that is that this controversy over sending out the screeners to members of the Academy in the leading up to the voting for the awards. What happened was the Motion Picture Association of America, this is Jack Valenti's outfit, announced that they would ban the mailing out of DVDs of movies to members of the Academy. And previously what happened was that to make sure that everybody gets a chance to see the movies and then when they vote on them, the studios would send copies of the movie. The MPAA said, well, they're very concerned about piracy. They think, well, some of these are going to end up in the hands of pirates, and I guess it has happened. So they first of all said, no, no screeners. And a lot of people objected, particularly the people who were trying to get attention for smaller films, because they felt that was the way that some of the they could get the Academy members to actually see the movies, and that there was some possibility of them winning some awards. And so the MPAA got so much pressure, they said, okay, okay, we'll let you send out tapes, but they've got to be tagged so we know if any of them end up being duplicated and distributed. So it seems like that this whole issue of the screeners for the moment is up in the air, and I wonder what you think is going to happen with that and what that ultimately means for people who are trying to promote independent films.
Well, I can tell you what I hope is going to happen, which is that, you know, they'll figure out a way to protect screeners, you know, from piracy and be able to continue sending them out, because screeners were a real boon to the independents, as you pointed out. I mean, it's a way of leveling the playing field. Small companies don't have the money and the means to screen their films with enough frequency that every Academy member can see the films. So screeners were an easy way to disseminate the product, the material, the film, so that people, you know, Academy members could see them when the screeners. So ending or banning screeners favors the studios, and it was a big, big blow to the independents. And I think that one of the interesting things about that controversy was that the studios were shocked and I think completely taken aback by the outcry whipped up by the independents, and it's an indication of the extent to which independents have gotten a foothold in sort of American culture. The backing that they were able to mobilize, I think, really was a reality check for the studios.
Well, I think also, isn't it true that some people really said that that this was the ban on the screeners was a direct kind of slap in the face to Harvey Weinstein and Miramax?
Well, I think that there was a sense that possibly some people felt that the studios were tired of the independents winning all the Oscars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Since Miramax, I guess, wins more Oscars than any other independent, I guess you could say it was a slap at Miramax. But it was also self-defeating because, again, as the caller pointed out, all these companies have their own independent divisions. So they're really, cutting off their noses to spite their faces. I guess they felt that they're going to lose more in piracy than they would gain, in grosses by having their divisions win Oscars. But as I said, I do think they were taken aback by the amount of the vocal protest, in favor of continuing to send out screeners.
Yeah. Well, we're at the point here we're going to have to finish. It's a fascinating book, and I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us to talk about it. We certainly appreciate it.
Well, thank you, David.
Our guest, Peter Biskind, and again, if you want to read the book, it's Down and Dirty Pictures. Subtitle is Miramax, Sundance, and the Rise of Independent Film, and the book is published by Simon & Schuster.